So we have a beautiful gathering tonight of students who've come so far. I find that very, really quite admirable that you, this is, we say that if you walk toward God, God will run to you. So that, you know, God is running toward you now. And because you've flown to God, God is running at the speed of light toward you. A journey, we call it a spiritual journey or a spiritual transformation. And it's, you know, it's the great, one of the great vehicles of Sufism, the zikr. It's one of the most powerful tools, spiritual tools that we have. Apart from the basic one of simply connecting the hearts, because it, we say that our hearts come into connection with each other. And just like a grape onto a vine, so that when the, imagine a grape that is unripe, that's fallen off the vine, well, it won't really ripen. It won't become sweet. It'll probably dry up and wither away. But the grape that's on the vine makes the sweet fruit that eventually makes the juice or the wine. And so the dervishes are on a vine. And the vine is really a kind of, you might say it's the presence of God through the hearts of the great sheikhs, the great teachers, the saints, the prophets. That's the vine. And to be connected on that vine is to have the sap of life flowing through you.
From the prayer before, you repeat some certain phrases.
Yes. Yes.
Well, does it like symbolize, or what is it?
You will see in the zikr we're going to offer. We repeat the phrase about. You know, could be 300 times even. So I'm not sure what we repeated there, Allahu Akbar, mostly. That's the one that stands out most from the prayer. And that, it's a, you know, it means many, many things, but among which, you know, that divine reality, the one whom we call God or Allah, is always beyond what can be defined or contained in any concept, and is always greater even than the manifestation that is visible. So we say God is both the manifest and the non-manifest. But it's very important, and Sufism, this is also I would say one of the gifts of Sufism is this balance, you know, the, both the manifest and the non-manifest. So we don't just say God is out there away. No, God is here, completely present here. Yeah. Yes?
I have two questions. The one is, during the prayer, you translated it to English. Mm-hmm. We went to a ceremony in Denmark, uh-huh. where we didn't understand any of it.
Right.
Is that normal in Sufism to translate some of it?
Well, I would say Sufism in America, I think it's going to be different. When, not in the East. Not in. It's all done in Arabic. The prayers are all done in Arabic. In fact, that's a very American gift. I think, coming from this country, it takes the daring of Americans and the, you know, the naivete and innocence to be able to say English in the prayer, because you know, it's unheard of over there.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think it's going to be spreading.
Yeah.
And I think it will, just as it did, you know, in the church, when I think it was under Luther that the language of the people came in, I think it's going to come. But what we don't want to simply translate out of the sacred language, because the difference, I would say, is that Latin, I mean, it had become a sacred language, or Greek, you know, through the very fact of being invested with sacred words, but it wasn't the language of revelation. But Arabic, you know, or what is that form, was the language of revelation. So we very much want to maintain it, but be bilingual. And, you know, some people might, I can see in the future, do their prayers entirely in their own native language. Perfectly possible. It doesn't invalidate the prayer at all. And that's a mistake of certain formalists who feel, well, if it's not done this way, it's not valid. What we say, the main thing is the purity of heart. And so this is one of the important distinctions between Sufism and the what is called the broader religion, is that in Sufism we put, so much emphasis is put on the state of the heart. That's it, you know. The intention of the heart, the purity of the heart. And so the entire path is really about bringing the heart to its original state of purity and luminosity, and freeing us from our limited self, what we call the limited self, which has been built up through education, through social conditioning, and becomes like a prison for the spirit and for the heart. So the Sufism is the going back to the root, our own root. And so we do not give up the form at all, you know, but we don't think that the truth is in the form. It's a kind of ambiguous. Sufis also have a part of they stand on paradox. The whole path is really, in a way, a path of paradox. And it's said by the great Sufi masters that the human being is a paradox. You know, our very existence, our very reality between the divine and the earthly. So Sufism is this path for the human being, for the complete human being. The actual prayer, what's called salat, is completed. Begins when we say Allahu Akbar, and we lift the men, brothers lift their hands like that, and the sisters like that, something like that. That's the beginning. And so from there till the end point, you don't speak. You know, you're not supposed to speak or look around or do anything else, but just be totally absorbed in the divine presence. Then the prayer formally concludes when you say Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. You give peace to the one on your right, and you give peace to the one on your left.
I have a slightly, I guess you could say, a slightly more political question.
Uh-huh.
And please don't take it the wrong way.
Okay.
But some 5 or 6 years ago, a certain Danish individual drew a drawing
right.
of Muhammad. Have you heard about it?
Yeah,
he's been criticized a lot, but I know a lot of the riots and
right.
uproars went down around the world, and I just wanted to hear if you experienced anything here, and what is your view on it?
Right. You know, I mean, I think it's the responsibility of every deep thinking person to look at where things come from. And so to me, it's of course it's painful if people do not understand someone I love and follow, as, you know, and not only myself, of course, but many, many millions of others over the years and generations. It's not so much that there are many millions, but just that I've been given a glimpse through my own teachers into the magnificence of this person called Muhammad, and to his gentleness and beauty and love and generosity and, you know, sweetness. So, of course, then it becomes painful when one sees miscomprehension. But then one has to look at the other side and say, well, where is, you know, where is such a motivation coming from to make such a drawing? And you don't have to look far. You know, you look at the behavior of certain people and see, of course, that could cause great fear in people or disgust or, you know, and then they would associate that with the founder in a way who's considered the founder. And of course, then you look further and then you see, speaking of, you know, social conditions, then you can look at social conditions in which those people live, and you see, you know, you begin, if you begin, the further you look, the more you have understanding for each side and each person and each situation and each expression. So you see, you know, great number of people in poverty, in political distress, social distress, colonized by European powers in the, you know, 18th, 19th centuries. But finally, we have to come to who we are today. You know, it's like a child. We grow up, we have a certain family. Maybe we had a difficult family situation. But by the time we're 40, you know, we have to say, okay, my beginnings were difficult, my conditions, but I take responsibility for who I am and what I do. And that's a very important part of Sufism, actually, and of every mature path. So, you know, it's not to justify, but it's just to say it's very hard to lay blame on anyone as soon as you start looking to the deeper roots, just like Jesus said, the one who has not sinned, throw the first stone, you know. So I tend to look at all the sides, and I would say, okay, what is coming about is a dialogue. It's the beginning of a dialogue. It's a world dialogue. And dialogues often begin in extreme conditions. You know, people are not interested in talking to other if everything's fine. Like before 9/11, no one who was not, you know, a Muslim in this country or a Muslim convert picked up a Quran. After 9/11, Qurans were sold. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Qurans went out to be read. That's the beginning of a dialogue between Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, you know, Judaism. So it's very interesting. But if we can see the positive side of things. So in the incident in Denmark, I actually saw, well, okay, God willing, this will lead to a better understanding of people, which I think it has. Look, I think maybe the fact of you coming here has been in part set off by that kind of dynamite explosion, you know. And here you are. This is wonderful. So, you know, we need to look both into the deeper origins of things and then also into the potential good results of things, where they can lead. And I see, you know, there's no question, a huge dialogue going on. It's not always fun or easy, but it's very necessary and can be very fruitful. So that's kind of my take on, you know, that. I consider it a blessing. In fact, in our path, and this is, you know, purely Quranic, but it takes, in a certain sense, a Sufi commitment to really live it fully, there is the wisdom that everything that happens is good. Now, we know that Voltaire, I don't know if any of you had to study Voltaire. Well, I had studied Voltaire, a little painful. He's a brilliant fellow. But, of course, part of his task there was to totally chop up the church, you know, and those beliefs that he considered naive. And that was its own, you know, that was necessary at the time and that particular process. But it's part of the depth of faith to see everything that happens as coming from divine goodness and divine mercy. Humanity is created as the crown of creation, as the heart of God, as the very essence of God. so that everything that pertains to the human being, everything and this entire creation pertains to the human being, and this human being pertains to the entire creation. Even though we cannot see all the billions of galaxies, we are all totally interrelated. They are part of us, and we are part of them. So, and all of this is through love, and for love, and to reveal love, and to bring about ultimate felicity and happiness and beauty and light in everything. So it's just our narrow perspective that makes us not understand that when things happen, we think, oh, that's terrible. Now, in a certain level, there are terrible things that happen, you know, terrible. But the terrible things can have amazing consequences. So what happened in Denmark was terrible. It set off such a painful, you know, it opened like a wound. But that wound was necessary. And finally, maybe the bringer of much good. So as dervishes, we strive to see everything that happens as a mercy. And so we apply our mind to seeing how it is a mercy. We might not always understand, you know, but we say, God is the merciful. God is the all-merciful. So, yeah. So your own background is mostly Christian? Uh-huh. Lutheran or what? Or no? Lutheran, mainly? Mm-hmm. Well, Luther was an amazing human being, you know, who brought, there again, you know, that was a difficult moment, but he brought a hugely needed reform into the church. And so I think we're finding also in the Islamic tradition that there's a group called the Progressive Muslims today, who are very much working in that way to bring Islam, in a certain sense, up to the, you know, cultural and intellectual present, you know, social present. So what you witness today, that men and women do prayer side by side, I mean, it's another group than we are, and we came to it through our own process. But they are doing work in a slightly similar way. I was just reading an article today that was sent to me on the group called Progressive Muslims, who are working to have women lead the prayers and to have, you know, also I think in the native language, and to have, you know, the gays completely accepted. Of course, that's not an issue for us. But I know in the normal religious community, it can be an issue. So
we went to this midday prayer.
Mm-hmm.
In just an ordinary Islamic mosque,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A mosque.
And women and men were separate from each other.
Right.
Well, that's the difference here. And some of the women in this room aren't wearing
a scarf. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I get the impression that this kind of Islamic religion is more free.
Yeah, this is more the atmosphere of Sufism, because the real quest of Sufism is, well, you know, we could put it in from two perspectives. The quest is God, and the quest is oneself. And in this path, they go together. And because the prophet said, to meet your Lord, you must know yourself. To know your Lord, you must come to know yourself. You must come to know who you are. And so this is very much the foundation of Sufism, is this journey to oneself, and then meeting God there through ourself, not away. But it's also, there are mirrors that are used that we say in a way that each other, we are mirrors for each other. And so the teacher is a mirror for the dervish. And in the mirror, really, the dervish sees their own soul, their own heart. So it is also using certain outer means to come finally, though, to one's own essence, you know. And we do this in a community through, as I said, by being the grapes on the vine. It's not an individualistic. On the one hand, it's, of course, each one is unique, and we do not make an amalgam. It's not at all like that. And but through being unique, we also recognize the same being who is here in me and everyone else. And so this is how we meet the other, by recognizing that one being. Yes.
Yeah. Are you born in America?
Yes.
Have you converted to this religion? Have you always been?
No, I was born Catholic, and okay. Catholic French parents, and.
I'm just wondering how much of you who have converted.
A lot of us, but about now it's a difference because the proportions have changed over the years. It's interesting. In our group in New York, if you travel further west, if you go to Mexico, it's almost like 99.9% of people who came from, you know, being Catholics or Protestants and who embraced.
Okay.
Yeah, but here now we have a different mix. I mean, you know, I personally feel, and this might be my own personal feeling, but I do feel that the tradition as a whole needs a tremendous renewal. In fact, there's actually the knowledge that every 100 years or so, there comes someone who's said to be the renewer of the religion, because everything tends to, you know, become rigid over time. Even the greatest things can become rigid. And so the Sufis, the Sufi path, the path of knowledge, the path of love, that is beyond the path of form and beyond the conventional religion, has always been actually side by side with Islam to, you know, renew it. Islam doesn't exist without Sufism. It would just totally dry up and disintegrate. And so it's not something that's well known, you know. And so the real renewers of the religion have come from these Sufi lineages, the Sufi tradition. And they're usually quite different people than what you would meet in a, you know, an Islamic school or that more formal traditional setting. They're very different. They can be totally surprising and unconventional, and many of them were killed and burned and, you know, misunderstood. They were considered heretics also. So we come from a tradition of that's our tradition, though. That's, you know, those are our forefathers and foremothers, are these radical people who wanted the truth. Radical people who stood out for love rather than convention, and who broke through convention, who, and yet did not always do so in an ostentatious way. They could be so subtle, they could be completely invisible, you know, and have great compassion for everyone. And so they were not, you had all kinds, every color, you know, has appeared in the Sufi garb. But, so it's a very creative path, a very sincere path. It's the path of sincerity, you know. Follow the heart. This is Sufism. So when we don't necessarily say we're Muslims here. In fact, I never say I'm a Muslim. First of all, I don't know. I don't know how God sees me. You know, may God accept. Yes, we say, please, God, you know, forgive me and accept me and count me among, you know, the ones you love. But we're not identified. We don't identify ourselves with too much. But we do follow the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. We do follow the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him. We do follow Hazreti Maryam and all the beautiful ones. Yes, Abraham. But, you know, the single foremost guide of us is the Prophet Muhammad and his family and successors. So, but they're all together. You know, in fact, the dervish path is said to be under the guidance of Jesus. So it's very surprising. Most Muslims wouldn't know that. You know, most Muslims don't know how universal their tradition is. It's a totally universal tradition, according to the Quran. Because it says in Quran, if you do not accept any one of all the messengers that I, God, have sent to the earth, you are not a complete Muslim. You are not a fully mature believer. So it's actually incumbent upon the one who says, I am a Muslim, to accept Buddha, Krishna, you know, Ramakrishna, all of the great ones, and in every sacred tradition. That's radical. But, you know, unfortunately, both in our own personal lives and in religion and in society, we don't follow the radical. We don't go to the root of things. So our path, we're going to the root. That's our goal, to come to the root. And at the root, we find God. And at the root, we find ourself. It's a paradox where we say, actually, only God is here. That's the greatest tenet of this path, is to say, there is only God. Even as individuals, we don't have separate existence. We don't have an actual separate existence that's unreal. We think we do, but we don't. It's really, again, like the grapes, it was as if a grape would say, I am independent. And that's how we think. That's our normal egoic thinking. We think, I am independent. I can do this. This is for me, you know. That's the grape thinking. It is separate from the vine. But for the illumined grape, the knows that it is part of the vine, that it only lives from the vine, and that in actuality it is nothing but the vine. So this is, you know, some of the basic teaching of Sufism. We are all part of God. We are not separate beings. And we rely on God every moment and instant of our life. And so our joy in life is to live that consciously and to live in that life of God, to live the life of God consciously and joyfully and generously, and then people become happy, amazingly enough. And then when they're happy, they share, you know. And then when they share, all of a sudden there's enough on the planet for people to eat, and there's enough land for people to dwell on, and there's enough food. And then people begin educating other people, their children and others, and all then the basic human values come to the fore. So I consider Sufism and any mystic tradition, any true mystic tradition, which really brings one to the core of one's being and to the truth, as the source of all happiness. That's why I don't follow too much politics. I don't really believe in it. You know, I've seen how it goes. The only solution to human happiness is for the human being to come to their own heart and to live from there, you know.
Experience
it directly. Direct experience, of course, not just reading about it. That's why it's good. It doesn't matter if you haven't read a book. But she had her hand up first, and then I'll go. But you haven't. I haven't heard from you, so let's go to you first.
You just used the example of a grape attached to a vine to illustrate your point, but would you say the grape has a choice between being illuminated and aware and not being? I guess I'm asking.
No, it's interesting what you're saying. Does it have a choice?
Yeah, because, you know, I don't really think the apples growing on the trees do have a choice between...
You're right.
And they can't really control if a worm comes and...
you're right. You're right.
Saying, or if it's taken down too early, or... If it's just lit to grow and then it falls and it withers away. So what do you think about that?
I agree with you. Ultimately, it doesn't have a choice. But if you speak to people that way, that knowledge that ultimately this is all one movement of God, and we don't, as separate, little thinking beings, have a choice, would be very, could be damaging. So because there is a relative place where we do have a choice, and where we do have initiative, and where we must take responsibility. Even that, of course, you could say comes from that movement, but still, we must take it. We must take that responsibility. Go ahead.
I was just thinking, because it's funny you say we have the choice to tell people whether or not this happens, but in that we also, it will happen either way. If we tell them or if we don't tell them, it's still the same, because if we tell them, we're going to tell them, and if we don't tell them, it's because we're not going to tell them.
Right. But there can be a fallacy. The only problem is that until we're completely clear, it can become a trap. It can become a spiritual trap, where we're not seeing then that we're actually functioning mechanically. As long as there is some mechanism functioning in us, and I mean what we call the limited self, we must take responsibility for that. And say we are making a choice. I choose today to get up and say thank you, God, instead of complaining. Let's say that we have two choices. Hypothetically, it's very important for us, until we are completely, totally transparent to God, to follow that path, to choose. So it's subtle, but we have to keep choosing the good. It's helpful to have what's called a spiritual friend or a guide or someone to, not let you get stuck on things like that. Maybe that would be a good Zen koan, and if you contemplate it long enough, it will bring you to another level.
I guess that's what's going to happen, because if you get stuck, it's because you're supposed to get stuck.
Yeah.
So, but it's got to be,
right.
If you think there is no point in life, I don't have a choice anyway, so I might not be able to do anything, that's because that's what's supposed to happen.
Right. There it's very subtle, but that can become a spiritual sickness.
Yeah.
It's only when we're totally in touch with our root, completely clear, that we can see where all the movement and initiative is coming from. So, it's like it said, it's like a fly right on the back of an elephant. So that's, in a way, a metaphor, like a kind of Rumi-like metaphor. I don't know if you actually use that one, but so we think, we're doing this. Oh, this is my life. I'm doing all this. And we don't see the elephant beneath us, that all of the power, every breath we have, every inspired thought is coming from that one, when we can see that, then we can truly say, okay, I do not take initiative. But as long as we are in our limited state, we must take that responsibility. So I would say, discourage you from getting caught too much into that intellectual box. And because come to your heart, and the heart is always free, because the heart is with God. The heart is God. So in a sense, you, as your heart, as your divine being, is free. But you definitely touched on something that... What?
It wasn't because I was looking for direct answer. I just wanted to...
air it, to bring it out.
To know how you perceive it, because that's the way of finding the answer.
Right, right. Well, my... response to you would be, go to your heart, find your heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but you look like a person of heart. I can see that. and oh, he's got. yes. Now go to you. You said.
Sorry for my amount of questions.
That's
and
good.
I hope that you won't get offended. But
no.
In Denmark, I think that a lot of us see the stories of the Bible as a metaphor for the message.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask you whether or not the Sufist way is to see it as a metaphor or see it as a direct story.
Right. Well, it, you know, I mean, this is a, you all hitting, you're all very alive minds and beings, because that touches on a very deep also dialogue within the entire Islamic community. You know, it's both. Because, so we take these stories on all levels, just as our life itself is both the actual event, and then it's a metaphor also. You know, it has a signification. It has inner meaning. And so it's the same with the prophetic stories in the Quran of the prophets, you know. But I personally take them as actual, and I think the general ummah, you know, the general community takes them as actual. So, and not as metaphors, but when you begin reading the meanings within, so let's take the story of Joseph, alayhi salam, the story of, you know, the youngest son of Jacob, who was left by his brothers in the desert, put in the well, and then brought by the merchants to Egypt and sold, and then became the vizier. And well, this is both taken as an actual story, and it's taken as a metaphor of the human heart, you know, of the human journey. The one who is not recognized as the we would call it the sultan, or as the vizier, let's say, of the heart, you know, and how that gets lost and it gets buried and it gets sold. We sell our own self. And then brought into, you know, a foreign land, and then there it becomes elevated again. So that might be the journey, the mystic journey, by taking the travel. Often travel is often seen as a mystic journey. Mystic journey is travel, you know. So they have both. Another example is the hand of God. Well, some, and here you would get differences among Sufis, would say, well, that's a metaphor. But there are other Sufis, great Sufis, who would say, no, that's not a metaphor, that's actual. If God speaks of his hand, then there's actually a hand there. And that brings us to another level of Sufism, where the human being becomes the mirror of God and the representative of God, and becomes the hand of God and the seeing of God and the movement of God. You know, these are some of the great mystic sheikhs. They've attained that place where they have become completely divine, like the Buddha, how we would see the Buddha, you know, or how, you know, I don't want to bring Jesus because I know, you know, that's a different, but I'd say the Buddha, seen as divine. Well, some of these mystic sheikhs are like that, and that they have become so much merged in God that every movement of theirs is God's movement. God's movement within this realm of manifestation, you know. So yes, it's both literal and beyond, because there is nothing just literal. So everything, if we're sitting on this rug has also an inner significance, an inner life, and a good, interesting questions. That's it. Yes.
This may not be in a religious context, but I'd like to know how you live your life. You know, do you live it day by day?
Like, yes. Even less than that.
or do you think forward? Or is it...
Yeah.
Maybe I can put it in another way.
Okay.
For you, would you mind if you die today? Is it as good as dying tomorrow?
That's beautiful. Well, that's a good question. You know, it's said that the totally prepared one, of course, should be ready to die today. I don't know. I'm not certain. You know, I'd like to say yes. I'm not 100% certain that I probably would feel, oh my God, you know, I still have some evolving to do. That, you know, yeah, I would probably be afraid to die today because I would feel that I would return, even though, you know, there's great things there, but I probably would feel that I'm not quite cooked yet. You know, that can be said by the ones who are truly cooked. They're ready to go at any moment. So that's the gist of your question. That's the essence of your question, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful question. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So that's, but again, that should be the, you know, the contemplation of each of us. Yeah, am I ready now? Am I ready now? You know. I mean, I don't think I would, if, you know, who knows? Allah knows. That's a good thing for us to say, too, you know, that really God knows the best what our state is and so how we would react. Because it's one thing for me to say, well, yes, I think I'd be ready more or less to go, but I don't know 100% until it would happen. Yeah. There's a beautiful metaphor, actually, from the more from the Hindu tradition, that it says that for the soul of the completely mature one, the soul leaves the body like a hair comes out of melted butter, you know. And it's a true statement, I think, also in the Islamic tradition, that it said that the angel of death actually comes and brings the soul out. And so for the mature person, the one who's worked with that in mind, who's prepared themselves, you know, they are ready, more or less, even though great ones have hesitated. So, but it's not painful. It would be a bliss for them. It's a bliss, an increase of bliss, let's say. They're already in bliss. So, but God does say in one of the traditions that among all the things I do, I dislike the most to do is to, you know, bring the one of my believing servants, one of my loving servants, to cause them to die, to bring them to that moment, to remove the soul from the body. So it's interesting. So that indicates that, what does that indicate? You know, because you think, well, that's funny, because exactly, the great lovers of God should actually want to, and many of them do express that desire. But it shows how great this world is, how great this life is, while the soul is in the body, what great potential there is, what great good that person is also bringing, you know. And that's, it says, when a lover leaves this world, and you know, those of us who've been around and survived the passing of our teachers, we know that. They say the earth and the sky weeps, you know, because they were such a bounty for the earth. And there, you know, there is a joy to being in this earth. When you have become fully a lover of God, then everything becomes God. You know, you're not separate anymore. So death does not become the unveiler anymore. It's just another station on the way. It's part of the ongoing path, journey of the soul. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Do Sufis believe in reincarnation?
It's another good question. Do Sufis believe in reincarnation? Some do and some don't. You know, which is interesting. Shows you the range of Sufism. Sufism is not dogma. There is no dogma. If there's dogma, it's not Sufism. Sufism is experiencing the truth directly. in oneself. The oneself is that laboratory of truth. And that laboratory can yield many different results. But the result will always be that God is love and God is merciful, and that the human being is great, you know, that the human being is the manifestation of God. So, but within that, you know, things like reincarnation, there are different... I personally don't hold to reincarnation, but maybe because I haven't fully comprehended it, but it feels to me like a limitation, you know, like as though there's a certain number of souls who would keep returning. God is infinite and the infinite creator, and so it's not that we don't keep journeying. We keep journeying and we keep evolving, and you know, but we don't have to come back to Earth to replay this particular life. Our life goes on. Once the Kun brought us into being, where God said be, and we came to be what is known as these individual essences, came to be, the journey is infinite, you know. So it's a little different, but you know, I once asked Sheikh Noor that, my teacher, one of my teachers. I said, well, is it reincarnation or is it just one way through this earth? And he said, he had a very interesting answer. He said, well, whatever will increase your faith. Believe in that. Isn't that interesting? To dogmatic people, they wouldn't like that answer because they like to think that what they believe in is absolute. But this way, it shows belief as, you know, serving the faith, you know. So the main thing is the faith, is the light of faith in the heart, that love and that faith and that light. But so whatever serves that. So you're free to adhere to it or not as a Sufi. And some Sufis do. There are many great Sufis who have. Mm-hmm. So now, next we're going to our zikr, which is the real thing you've come for. Lovely. Thank you so much. God bless you all, really, for coming all this distance. And it's amazing.